Hi everyone, my name is João and I'm your host of the Software Crafts podcast. Today with us we have Andrea Golet. She's a sought after keynote speaker for conferences around the world, empowering audiences to deepen their technical skills for understanding and communicating with others. She's best known for her work defining empathy-driven development, a framework that helps software engineers anchor their decisions and deliverables on the perspectives of the people who will be impacted by what they create. Andrea is the co-founder of Cogibytes, a software consultancy that helps organizations pay down technical debt and modernize legacy systems. You can recognize her by the JavaScript tattoo on her wrist and learn more about her work at empathyintech.com. Welcome to the show and thanks for your time.
Yes, thank you. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Yes, we were talking on off and I was already triggered. And to keep the conversation going, the heuristic for today is related to your work and it's empathy system architecture. What can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I've been working, so I'll start with maybe a little bit of my background. I am from the business. I spent a decade as a marketer and a copywriter. And part of that work required me to have very deep technical skills of empathy and communication. And by happenstance, I ran into a friend from high school. He asked me to join his startup to help with the business side of things. And we ended up really loving legacy code and helping teams pay down technical debt. And what was interesting was that I started to notice there were a lot of patterns, not so much related to the technical, you know, framework or whatever that you were using. A lot of the reasons that code got to a state where it was difficult to work with were more communication patterns. And we started to see things like Conway's Law and things like that. And so I started to really think through kind of what my experience from my past career could I apply here. And so my work now is around empathy-driven development, which is about how do we imbue our and embed good communication into our system. One of the books I love is Cyril Martinet's book, Living Documentation. I think that's a really good example. But I think as we think about, like, there's the tactical and kind of the atomic level, but one thing that's useful is to think about things systemically. And we think about computer architecture all the time. And most of us who are in software are kind of familiar with, you know, the von Neumann model. And even if you don't know that it's the von Neumann model, it's probably pretty familiar where it's inputs, processing, outputs, and storage. And empathy, as I've been doing all this research to try to really articulate this, actually can be mapped to a very similar system where you have sensing, which is your inputs into the world. You're interacting with something. You have neurons that are taking in physical signals and converting them to electrical signals that your brain can then perceive. So that's the processing aspect of it, is perception. And then you have to communicate. So communication is an expression of your perception. And everyone communicates, both verbally and not verbally, you know, the way we dress, our, you know, tone of voice, and then also artifacts. So this is kind of where it differs a little bit, because a lot of the models that I've seen, so this is by far not the first, you know, model that equates computing to human in human cognition. Von Neumann himself, actually, that was one of the last papers that he was writing. He had it unfinished, but it was called The Computer and the Brain. I think it was Stuart Card and Thomas Moran who did human-computer interaction. But when we've seen this, it's mostly been on the individual level. And the way that we've thought about storage, it's been about memory, like our own individual memory. But when we're thinking about interacting with others, which is, you know, there's self-empathy, but for the most part, empathy requires some kind of interaction. We need to rethink how we think about storage. And when we're thinking about software, we need to think about how will something that I write be retrieved by someone else? Because the way you name a function or a commit message or, you know, user-facing documentation, all of these different tiny elements, whether or not it's in a computer-oriented language or natural language, you are leaving an artifact of your thinking behind. And when we focus on developing quality communication artifacts that have been anchored on a perception of someone else rather than just our own kind of self-centered and short-sighted perspective, then we start to really pay down the technical debt much faster. And it can be just a quick thinking thing, because all of us sense and perceive and communicate and develop artifacts. But do we do it with intention? And do we really understand what's going on behind the scenes? And it's kind of like when I came to software, I was used to using a user interface and kind of moving things on the screen, but there was this whole world of code that I had never seen before. I didn't know the magic that was happening behind on the back end. And in our human system, we have something that's very similar and we can understand it. Research is showing us that empathy is very much a skill that can be built. And so given that I've spent time in both of these worlds, I feel like I'm really enjoying helping to translate some of these concepts of empathy and communication that have been seen as really squishy and soft skills, and making them really concrete and contextual so that we can actually apply them to our code bases.
Well, that is definitely a thing that I recognize, I can tell you, right? Because people go, oh, or you are empathic or not. And I discover that can be built and trained as well. So I recognize even myself. But also you trigger me with one thing there. So I'm a student of social technical systems. And one of the things on Jay Bloom's research is uses the concept of hyperobjects that comes from Timothy Morton, also a philosopher. And the interesting things about hyperobjects are objects or phenomena that cross both space and time. So the person was on social ecology and use global warming, right? Affects everyone yep. in the globe and crosses time and space. But also if we think software have these properties, right? A piece of software, what we are using these to for this interview, crosses space and crosses time, can be done today,
absolutely,
tomorrow, right? And now you are connecting the talk about legacy systems. They cross time and space.
Yeah, that's the definition of legacy, something that you're passing down or inheriting, right?
Exactly, but needs to be maintained. It's an entity that needs to evolve, right? So it's very interesting now that this layer on empathy and the impact on social technical systems and the perception that we have that, oh, these people doing software just throw some pizza under the door and software will pop up. So it's very interesting, your take, and bringing these together. So after this long rant, what was the trigger, your point on your career that you said, aha, this is it, right? Because in your story, you came from the business, then working in legacy system. But what was the point that was, okay, this is what binds it together?
Yeah, there were two. So the first one was Scott and I had been running the business together for about 4 years. I had been sitting next to him coding, but I very rarely built software on my own. I almost always paired with Scott. And when I went to conferences, everyone thought I was a recruiter, even though it was like, I'm a CEO, I'm coding in JavaScript and Ruby. Does that even count? And so I would get asked at conferences all the time, are you technical or non-technical? That was often the very first question out of the gate. And the way I present, I'm more feminine. I like don't try to change. I don't like wearing graphic t-shirts. I tend to look like a marketer. I talk like a marketer. And culturally, I think people just felt I was a fish out of water 12 years ago. So I could understand it, but then I started incorporating that into my identity in a way that I wasn't even conscious of. So Scott was on his very first podcast. Like we were really excited. we were on the way to go visit his grandmother. And so we decided to listen to the podcast on the trip. And at the end, the host asked, "What's your origin story?" to Scott. I wasn't on the podcast. And he said, "Oh, yeah, well, you know, I have a degree in computer science and I do the technical. And Andrea is our non-technical founder." And it was interesting because hearing my business, who we were life partners at that point, too. We had gotten married about 3 years after running the business together. I was like, "What? Why did you call me non-technical? That's like, of all the people." And so Scott was very quiet and he said, "Well, I just use the language that you use to describe yourself. You describe that. I just pulled almost exactly your pitch to clients that I've heard you say over and over again. And so when you start calling yourself technical, so will I." And that was like existential crisis, right? And I really had to start thinking about what is technical and what is not technical and why do I think that I'm not technical? And it was this whole exploration of why do we think, and I realized that it's kind of two sides of the same coin, because Scott had the cultural, you're not good with people, you're good with machines. You are completely logical and devoid of emotion. And we see this culturally in all the movies and things like that. And so it was like, why do we think this way? So there was a lot of self-exploration. And then there was a conference that had invited me to speak. And I was just feeling really, I had a lot of self-doubt and imposter syndrome. And they had asked me to give a technical talk. And this is in the process of like that, like, am I technical? Am I not? And so I replied back and I said, I am not the best person to talk about a specific technology. However, I would be happy to prepare a talk about how empathy is a technical skill because I feel very confident in that subject matter. And I was convinced that they were going to laugh because, and it was almost like that, but they instead asked me to keynote. So it's been very interesting that as soon as I realized that I didn't have to conform to what everybody thought I should be, and instead I can take this experience that I have and then really talk about the technical aspects of it and have conversations about how, no, this really is something that you can dive so deep in any one of these different areas. So just like you can look at embedded systems and you can go really deep into kind of the hardware of, you know, computer system architecture, same thing. Like there are scientists who spend their entire careers like studying like how neurons, you know, pass information back and forth, or same thing with perception or sensing or communication. All of this is deeply, deeply, deeply technical. You can spend a lifetime learning it. It's just, do you know where to go? Do you know what to call things? Do you know where to look? So that's kind of been where, you know, the more people have then asked me to talk about it, I was like, okay, well, I think there's something here. So yeah, it's been fun to kind of meld these two worlds and explore things in a new way, because I think in some aspects, my favorite conferences that I've gone to have really crossed the border where they are talking about technology, but they're also talking about philosophy and linguistics and, you know, social economic systems and all of these kind of other things other than just the bits and bytes that are flowing through the electrical systems.
Yeah, I can see that, right? Because this is also a thought that is with me for a long time. This is also the misinterpretation of people. Oh, just go and put that, right? Because indeed, software starts with a very clever group of folks that automated some functions, namely on accounting domain. If you press F1 and F2, this pops up and then people start to have the requests. And I was having this discussion a while ago, right? Also with a person in this podcast, Agile popped up as a counter movement against bad management. And the quality of software evolves so much and they have this plastic quality, right? Software changes we want. We call it a product, but the Microsoft that you have in front of you, you cannot change it. We produce it, done. But software has this plasticity that changes as we want. But we don't change our mindset around it. We don't change our social fabric. We don't say we still think that we are in a factory plan, something in, something out. And we sometimes forgot that software is a social activity, as I call it, which, right? You told, well, I pair back then, I pair a lot. Well, social activity, right?
Yeah.
And I do believe that now with your work, for instance, and work of others, we are getting this breakthrough, as you mentioned before, moving from the individual, because also lots of the books are learn this programming language, learn this cloud provider, look how awesome this is. And I believe that there are not enough books focused on systems. You know, Team Topologies came out and was, you know, even the flow. Dynamic reteaming came out. How can we make? You are talking about
my quote is on the back. I love Heidi. Mine's the one in the big green.
Exactly.
And I love dynamic.
And I feel that now we are getting towards the group. Your description of the artifacts as a group. How can we get that out? I'm really curious, in your head, what are these practices that we need to change to really harness the power of a crowd?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think first is recognizing that empathy is a technical skill. I think the first thing is to develop an empathetic mindset, because I have so many developers who come up to me who have been practicing code for a long time. And what I've found is that the typical way that computer science is taught, and this goes all the way back, I read a paper by Dave Parnas in the 1960s, and he was saying that his professors in the 1950s were telling him to think like a computer. And I've heard so many different people, and we need to recognize you can build on that. That is an empathy skill. That is a specific skill of perspective taking. So you are already doing this in your daily practice if that's something that feels comfortable to you. What we should do is not replace that or say that that's wrong, but let's extend that skill to think about other people. So the framework that I typically recommend that is kind of a behavioral or heuristic is what I'm calling an ADA loop, A-D-A. And if people are familiar with the OODA loop, it's kind of a similar thing where it's a constantly running thing, and it works very well in kind of a dynamic decision environment. It was originally designed for fighter pilots. OODA loop was. And that's what we're doing when we code. We need to constantly assess, like, how should my interactions change? And we need something that's not so rigid. So ADA stands for audience, decision, artifact. So what we've been doing on our team is, like, when you are coding and you kind of find a natural pause and you're thinking about what's the best way forward, what should I name this thing, how should I develop this thing, is to learn to pause, right? And that in and of itself is a technical skill, right? But learning to pause and then anchoring your decision. And I advocate for taking a broader approach. So rather than just thinking about the one person, there's actually four different types of audiences to run through. And sometimes when the stakes are really high, you want to take a lot of time, be very careful. Other times, you know, it's just a quick gut check. But the audiences, you want to start with yourself, right? And people find that kind of counterintuitive. But thinking about yourself, both in the future and in the past, and that's called transgenerational empathy, where you are looking at what would I need and what have I needed before? Where has my pain been? Where have I been frustrated? And then you can connect both cognitively and emotionally to that experience. And that's a great place to start, because then it primes you for making sure that you're not giving away. Because if you have empathy for everybody else, but not for yourself, then you're just a doormat. That's not empathy. But it also helps you kind of get into the practice of, like, this is something I can do. And you don't have to do necessarily a whole lot of market research to understand yourself and your own feelings, because you have them. You have access to them. The next audience that I recommend is the spotlight. So this is kind of your primary audience. You know, like if you're delivering something, like who will be immediately reading this, right? The next is the supporting. So if we're thinking kind of like a theater, right? So you've got the spotlight person, you've got the supporting cast. So this might be somebody's boss, right? Or somebody who might read it later, or somebody who's CC'd on it, right? But another perspective just to think about. And then last are the sidelines. So these are the people who you may not, they may not ever read it, but I know when I was in copywriting, one of the pieces of advice was never write anything down that you don't want to appear on the front page of the New York Times. And that was just a practice. And so, you know, sometimes, not every time, but sometimes when I'm writing something particularly sensitive, it's like, okay, if this appeared on the front cover of the New York Times, how could that be interpreted? And that can be just a useful exercise to help us think through a number of different kind of use cases. And like I said, sometimes it's slow, sometimes it's fast. And then based on that information, you can run through any number of decision frameworks, right? But taking that information and figuring out what you need to do with it, and then creating an artifact. So, or the, you know, hyper objects, but creating something that's durable. Because if we have a conversation and this was happening in the hallway, that would be an ephemeral artifact where we can't reconstruct it. But how can I make something that is retrievable and archivable, like that somebody else across time and space can interact with? And I think when we think about code, it's important to think not just about the quality of the artifacts, that's very good, but what we see in legacy systems actually is that there is a very low quantity of the artifacts as well. And this is important because you can't reconstruct meaning unless you have a certain number of things to go on. You can't look at like, what was the team's actual decision here? And as evidence of that, I point to kind of the linguistics between linear A and linear B. Linear B is a Minoan language that is kind of a predecessor to ancient Greek. And there was another one before that called linear A. Now with linear B, we can read it. There was some, I can't remember the name of the person, but there was a very smart person in the 1950s who was able to decipher linear B and assign meaning. And now we can read it and we can understand it. And part of the reason is because we've been able to uncover over 100,000 artifacts. And that's been able to help us assign meaning. Whereas with linear A, we only have about 7,000 artifacts. And mathematicians have done really interesting analysis to show that we would need between 12 and 14,000, I think is the number, artifacts to actually be able to understand meaning. So we can understand the syntax, we can understand the functionality of the language, but we can't understand that linear A semantically. We can't understand why somebody did that. You have to have a certain number. So that's part of the reason why I think leaving good documentation behind. And by documentation, I don't mean these long novels of describing what the code does. Sometimes that can be useful if you're giving a synopsis to an executive team, for example, right? But in general, thinking about how can I name this in a way that is going to assign a good amount of meaning? How can I leave a commit message that instead of just saying updates the API, updates the API, updates the API, updates the API, how can I assign something in a way where somebody can look at a bunch of different commit titles and get a sense quickly of kind of what my thought process was? And when you practice empathy skillfully while you code, those decisions become fairly obvious. But when you don't, then that's how legacy code gets written, is because the people who come after you can't assign a meaning and a context to what your work was.
Yeah, because when you start to triggering me that maybe this is a challenging question, definition of a legacy system is this property of reconstructing from the artifacts. And I was thinking why a system doesn't turn into legacy is because people can understand and system evolves, right? That plasticity that is from the system. and things that people don't understand, they have that behavior. Oops, I don't touch that. That can break.
Right. Right.
Do you feel exactly the same way? Is that what you mean? Or you discover and research?
I think that's what we discovered and researched. And I think also there is a function of when there is high quality, I mean, I don't necessarily have evidence to back this up, except for this evidence of kind of the difference between the Apollo communication infrastructure was versus the Challenger about 20 years later. And so we can look at this as a function of Conway's law. And so on the Apollo mission, every engineer, every person who worked on that project had a notebook that they would go and just keep and communication artifacts. And there was a real, I can't remember the name of the person who came in. I need to find that. But there was a manager who came in, and the person who was an electrical engineer said, "This is awful. This is chaos. We can't do it. Like, everything needs to be, you know, kind of very rigid." And this person said, "No, you want an emphasis on documenting ideas and getting them to pollinate and move around the system as fast as possible." So this would be a decentralized human system that would follow kind of Conway's law. And so everyone was able to very quickly put together ideas, whereas with Challenger, everything was more rigid. That was kind of the communication infrastructure. And so we created silos. People didn't talk to each other. There was a big push in 1968, there was a NATO conference on software engineering, where software turned from developers and programmers into this is a science. And what they did was they took the ideas of scientific management from Frederick Winslow Taylor, which had been popular in the 1900s, they tried to apply it to software. And so that's where we get Waterfall, because it worked on assembly lines. Let's try it. And there are still companies that run that way. And that's just an artifact of a decision that was made many years ago, right? But recognizing that all of these things have an impact. And when you have a system where individuals don't talk to each other, there is very little incentive to create artifacts. In fact, if you have a culture of shame and secrecy, there is a disincentive to share. And you also have to look at the culture and the incentive structure and, you know, behavioral systems. And that's why empathy becomes really important, because if you don't have the internal organizational and cultural infrastructure to support the production of quality artifacts, then you need to look at systemically, because if a single developer doesn't have the motivation, then that's a challenge outside of that one developer, right? And so it's both a individual out and then also looking at it systemically as well.
Which is very interesting, right? Those are the moments as we as industry, right? Go left and right and let's try that. And then when some ideas become dogma, and then become so into that doesn't help us as an industry. But I also have the feeling, and I had this discussion with another guest, I'm also seeing more and more people coming to the industry that didn't went to the formal education, right? More what we call the boot camps. And I think that's just because the absolute number of people is shifting, is also giving new perspectives, right? We don't need to be computer scientists, right? That knows the ins and outs. We can know less about the stack, but we solve problems, product problems, mm-hmm. business problems. So I think that we are in this interesting point where we are building all of this knowledge and be like, you know, the people that build houses. Are building houses as humans for a long time, so we learn from how not to build a house, right, or how to build a house. And I think that we are on that point, and I think that your work is this breakthrough. We have enough legacy systems, we have enough examples to start thinking maybe if we want to operate on this type of scenario, don't create scenarios, don't create artifacts if it is based on secrecy. Fine. If you don't want, do in the other way. And what are the practices? And I think that will be a call for action, because I'm very interested in what the community will pick up in your ideas and your co-author ideas and test different practices, right? Exactly what I saw in domain-driven design community.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing, is that this, you know, this idea of empathy-driven development, I hope that people embrace it, and I don't want it to become dogma. So the what I am positioning are heuristics. These are observations that I have made over, you know, a 25-year career in both, you know, user experience and, you know, all of these different arenas. And here's the thing, is that this already exists. It exists in product management. It exists in business. It exists in user experience. It exists even in web design. It's missing from the back end. Back end engineers have been exempt from this training. And so it's not necessarily that there is anything new here. It's just that it's being brought to this community. And I think the challenge has been, it is very difficult for someone who understands empathy, understands communication, to be able to have the knowledge of how to speak the language of backend engineering, because there is so much jargon and there are so many precise terms. And so I don't think that there has been necessarily a desire to keep this information secret, but it's been very challenging, because to create examples that are contextual and concrete requires an understanding of the ecosystem. Whereas if you're looking at product development, we use products as consumers, right? If you're talking about web design, like, we look at websites, we can, even if you don't design them themselves, like, you can understand that. But being able to understand encapsulation, right? Like, that requires a whole level of, like, understanding that is very difficult for somebody who doesn't have the domain knowledge to then apply these principles. So I feel like that's kind of where I have this experience that's kind of unique, because I have both. And so it's mostly just translating things that have already been done, and it absolutely will evolve. No one should be taking this stuff as dogma. And, you know, I hope that people reinterpret this. I hope that people find their own ways of doing this. Because I know Rebecca Wirfs-Brocks talks about heuristics a lot. And I think she was on your show talking about how, like, we need to develop our own heuristics. We don't need to, like, it is good, like, if you're learning something new, to kind of follow a recipe and say, okay, this is, let me get in the practice of this. But then evolve, right? Don't just follow recipes. Learn how to do this yourself. Dive into the science. It's always changing. And there is so much depth to all of this that it becomes a really fun kind of deep dive exploration that will never end.
It will never end. And you had a lovely call for action. But this episode has an end. Unfortunately.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. I could talk about this stuff all day.
So. Yes, I can imagine. But we are near the end. And to wrap this around, but you had a nice call for action. So contact Andrea on social media. I bet that she will continue developing these thoughts. But what are the resources that you recommend related to the topics that we discuss here today?
Yeah, I think there are a few books. First is Practical Empathy by Indy Young. And so Indy is a former software engineer. She is very prominent in the user experience community. She built a company called Adaptive Path that Wired wrote as having an outsized influence on the web as we know it. And so her thoughts are really great about thinking about how to do research and how to actively listen to people where you're not imbuing your own bias. Another is by Dr. Jamil Zaki, who runs the Stanford Social Neuroscience Laboratory and is studying empathy. His book is called A War for Kindness, and he has several different, he's mostly studying, I think, how empathy is a skill, and then how that translates to different aspects of empathy, like altruism. but he has this really fascinating, he has a TED talk too, but he has a really fascinating kind of way to capture a theory, which is he calls the Roddenberry hypothesis. So Gene Roddenberry was the creator of Star Trek, and it talks about how kind of the cultural norms impact our identity around empathy. And so he gives the example of Data and Deanna Troi. You are either one or the other. You either process information analytically, or you walk into a room and have telepathy and are overwhelmed by other people's emotions. And that we tend to think that empathy and empathetic capacity is a trait that is fixed, similar to adult height, but it's actually something that can grow. So he talks about kind of the science there. Yeah. And then I think living documentation is also really great, because that talks about the very specific ways that, while empathy may not be like explicitly stated, that book I think talks about how to generatively create artifacts in a way that is very much kind of what I'm trying to advocate for. So that's kind of a very tactical book as well.
Thanks. I will make sure that all of these references will be on description of these episodes, so the audience can pick those and even discuss with you or us. Will be pretty cool. And I want to say a big thank you to share this. My mind is racing a lot with new thoughts. So this was awesome.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And thanks everyone for listening.
You can follow us on Twitter at SCraftsPodcast. Visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or visit our page on LinkedIn. Hope to see you next week.